A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Making partner. It's every professional's dream, but what are the financial risks? More and more of us are cashing in valuable final salary pensions. The FT's Josephine Cumbo gives her take on the latest stats. And $100 oil. Could investors in the black stuff be in for some serious upside? Welcome to The Money Show, the FT's weekly podcast on personal finance and investing. I'm Claire Barrett, FT Money Editor, bringing you all of this week's news in downloadable form. Lawyers, accountants, general practitioners, veterinary surgeons, hedge fund bosses, public relations managers, and many other professionals can become partners or part owners of their practices or firms. But the high rewards from profit shares must be balanced against significant financial risks, including the possibility that it could all end in failure. I'm joined by Lindsay Cook, who wrote about this issue on the cover of FT Money last week. Welcome, Lindsay.
Good morning.
So becoming a partner requires a significant upfront investment, but like any investment, people do this in the hope that great rewards can be theirs in the future. So how much will you need to buy in?
Well, it starts at about 50,000, but that's not all, because often there are further payments over the next 10 years and the big magic circle companies require quite a bit more. It's a long-term investment and initially the income may go down. People lose their pension rights in as much as they no longer have an employer, because they become self-employed, they no longer have an employer to pay a contribution to their pension.
So it's a really big step from being a salaried employee, PAYE, to becoming a part owner of the firm, but albeit one with huge financial risks that you're exposed to, as you were just detailing. But surely the temptation of having that fat profit share instead of a paltry salary is enough to push most people over the line.
I think you have to do the research, because in the early years, junior partners get far less. There's a lockstep, so you get far less. You earn points as the years go by. So it could be seen by some of the junior partners that they're doing all the work. They brought new money into the partnership, doing all the work, and they're getting a lot less. Some companies even have performance indicators for their junior partners, so they don't get the riches that they're promised. Some might even feel that they're there as a funder of the business that might need it more than is clear from the outset. So you have to do a lot of research. You need an advisor. You need to talk to friendly partners. If you're a woman, that's even more important because the contract, the membership agreement won't necessarily have maternity leave, because many of these have been written years ago. You've got to work out, find how well the organisation will help you. Will it help you with flexible working? Does it have a retirement date that is fixed in stone? All sorts of things.
And what other risks do potential partners need to add in to the equation? It's not just about your personal finances, it's also about the firm's finances.
Yeah, it is. You need to look at the return on capital that it is producing. You have to go through their accounts and look if they are spending more on building costs or salaried employees than they're bringing in revenue, if their fee income is declining. The Solicitors Regulation Authority actually fined a number of solicitors earlier this year for allowing their firm to draw more in profits than they were making. And they also, in a report 3 years ago, warned that there were quite a number of companies doing this as a matter of course. Now, if you've got great reserves, it may be something you can do in a year when you're moving offices or something like that. But you really need to look at it like a business, and get, if you don't have a business eye, get somebody else to check it out for you.
And one thing that I enjoyed reading about in your article was the things that can happen to draw on those funds, which you might think are coming to you as part of the profit share, when another partner retires, because effectively their share has to be paid back.
Absolutely. It's usually paid over 2 or 3 years, because the amount, if you're an established partner in a profitable company, you're going to get quite a whack of money at the end. So you may get it over 2 or 3 years. But it could be, if you've got quite a few oldies in your company, that they look for 10 or 15 new partners to actually fund the exiting people.
Well, thanks very much there to Lindsay Cook, our Money Mentor columnist. If you'd like to read Lindsay's feature all about the financial risks and rewards of becoming a partner, you can do that on our website, ft.com/money. The amount of money flowing out of final salary pension schemes more than doubled last year, according to new data released this week by the UK's Financial Conduct Authority. Those cashing in can certainly receive dazzling sums, but will they later regret giving up the certainty of an annual index-linked income in retirement? Josephine Cumbo, the FT's pensions correspondent, joins me now in the studio to discuss. Welcome, Jo. So, how much money has been transferred out?
Well, last year, a whopping $21 billion was transferred out of defined benefit schemes, which, as you said, was more than double the $7.9 billion transferred out in 2016. In terms of actual numbers of individuals transferring, last year there were 92,000 people giving up their final salary or defined benefit pensions, or a 50% increase on the year before.
So what's driving this trend?
There's two key things driving this trend. The first is, as you mentioned, dazzling lump sum offers. When you have a defined benefit pension, it's packaged up as an income, you get a spousal benefit, etc. But when you want to transfer that out, what the pension scheme will do will convert that benefit into a cash lump sum. Now, about 4 years ago, the typical amount that you would get off an offer for the cash lump sum was about 20 times your expected income. What we've seen in recent years is that expected income, that commutation factor, as they call it in the technical speak, has risen to about 35 to 40 times pension income. So this has resulted in people getting offers of six figures, life-changing amounts to transfer out their defined benefit pensions, which has proved irresistible to many people. So they've been transferring driven by these large offers. And what's behind those increases is this, technically speaking, that when interest rates are low, that has this side effect, very simply, of inflating offers for people to transfer out their pensions. That's very simply how it's worked. So there's the first factor of very big lump sums, record high lump sums, which have proved very attractive to people. And the second factor has been the pension freedoms. I'm sure many people have heard about these new changes that came in 2015, which have given people more flexibility outside of a final salary pension, but you have to move your money to a DC pension. You transfer it to a DC pension, a defined contribution pension, which is the same pension wrapper. From age 55, you can take that money as a lump sum or as and when you wish, and it's even more attractive to pass on that pot to your children. So those are the two key factors which have been driving transfers.
Well, should this worry the regulator? This is an awful lot of people now who are being dazzled by the lump sums, as you say. Now, they're giving up quite a valuable thing, the certainty of an income in retirement. Every year that they live, they'll get this lump sum, and that's to be weighed up against having a big pot of money that they'll then have to manage as an investment or pay somebody to manage for them.
Well, since the news broke about this big jump in transfers, a lot of people have come out and said, yes, the regulator should be alarmed about this, because the regulator's position remains that most people are better off keeping their valuable final salary pensions, which you said is protected and will deliver a guaranteed income. So there are concerns that there might be some instances of mis-selling going on in the market. Now, if you've got a pension pot that is worth, or a DB fund worth more than £30,000, which most people will have, and their offers are
especially
much,
with the 40 times
absolutely much ratio. Bigger. More common is around £250,000 is a typical offer at minimum, basically. You need to get advice. You need to go to a professional and get a recommendation on whether this is a good idea for you. Now, that's a safeguard because the regulator still thinks it's most people shouldn't give up their pension. So there is a lot to be concerned about in terms of the increased rise in transfers. The regulator is currently looking at the market, it's probing to see whether advice has been good enough. But unfortunately, last year it reviewed a number of cases and found that half of the cases that it reviewed, the advice wasn't suitable. So there are problems out in the market.
Well, a story that will no doubt run and run because, of course, once you've transferred your final salary pension, there is no way of getting the money back in. Well, thanks very much there to Josephine Cumbo, the FT Pensions Correspondent. You can read more on this story on ft.com/money. And please join me in congratulating Jo on her triumph at the Headline Money Awards last week, where she was voted Pensions Journalist of the Year for the second time running. Finally, analysts have been speculating, yet again, that the price of oil could yet break through the $100 a barrel barrier. The price of the black stuff has certainly surged since the beginning of this year. Joining me to discuss why is our adventurous investor, David Stevenson. Welcome back, David.
Hi.
So tell us briefly, what is it that's making the oil price surge? There are many reasons.
Yeah, there's no one particular reason. Geopolitical risk is never that far away from the oil price. So obviously concerns about Iran are weighing on investors' mind because, of course, if the U.S. sanctions, increases sanctions on Iran, that potentially takes some Iranian supply out of the main mass market. There's also concern about, frankly, just global growth. I mean, that I think is a really interesting story. It's just a lot more global growth than everybody expected, and that's feeding through particularly from emerging markets, slightly less so from developed markets, but emerging markets and demand for oil. But I think the other more interesting thing is that oil, we tend to get very fixated on the kind of big structural factors, you know, there enough investment going in, you know, geopolitical risk. But actually, quite a lot of it's just to do with stuff at the margins. So classic example is Venezuela. Is currently going through something of a, how can I put it politely, meltdown, and to the point where actually a lot of their oil workers can barely have enough food to actually carry on working, and that's affecting supply. And those margins don't sound very much, so I think it's something like from about 1.9 million barrels of oil per day down to 1.4. It doesn't sound very much, but you take out 500,000 or a million there, or there's a supply outage, stuff at the margins that can make a big difference on both sides. So if you get a lot more unconventional oil and gas from America, that's an extra increase in supplies. But you have to look at the margins of stuff. And the margins at the moment suggest that oil supplies are tightening, inventories are tightening, and that's pushing prices up. And also, let's not forget that OPEC is doing its best to push up the oil price.
So price of Brent crude, which is the international benchmark, was touching one of them was touching $80 a barrel on Friday. And you talk about in your column this week a report that came out from a firm of analysts really making a strong case for oil getting past $100 a barrel. So what's your crystal ball, as the adventurous investor, telling you?
Murky. So they weren't the only ones. A big American investment bank have also predicted that prices could go up to $100. The arguments, I think, are not bad, actually. They sound pretty strong. You know, it's, again, these arguments about what happens at the margin. It's the other thing that's also gone on is that when oil prices really cratered and went below $40, a lot of oil companies basically shuttered their capex expenditure programs and stopped developing some oil fields. And that has a knock-on effect. You just have to accept that big industries like oil and mining, they have a kind of very long lag time in how they react to things. And that flows through into their capital expenditure programs. And if they don't spend a lot of money, they don't have a lot of extra capacity when the demand picks up. And that's also still very much kicking around. So there's lots of factors lurking around. And I think the argument saying that oil could stay above $70 or $80 a barrel looks quite strong for the next year or two, assuming that global growth continues in its relatively strong state at the moment. That's the big assumption. None of us can know what will happen. I myself am not convinced that oil will go to $100 for the simple reason that I think it would concern the inflation hawks. You might see interest rates rise more sharply in the U.S. And I think particularly the Saudis are mindful that they're doing well at the moment. They're making a lot of money from oil. they really can't afford to effectively precipitate a global recession by pushing prices up too sharply, and then they'll see their revenues go back and they'll have their problems of discipline again. So my hunch is that we probably won't see oil up to $100, but you could certainly see oil staying above its putative range, which I always thought was likely about 40 to 60, could stay more in the 60 to 80 range. The other big unknowable is what happens with these US unconventional oil, gas, shale people drilling out the Permian Basin, the Bakken Basin. And they're mincing this at the moment because this is great news for them. Anything, frankly, above $50-$55 a barrel is great news for them. And the good news, I suppose, on one respect, is that they don't seem to be going completely ballistic in just turning out, bring out loads of new drilling rigs and just, you know, pumping oil out of every single nook and cranny. They're being quite careful about capital discipline, and that's feeding through into the profit margins. But who knows what will happen there? We could see a gusher of capital come in, output radically increase. But you're probably not likely to see the effect of that on oil market for maybe for another 12 months.
Okay, well, lots of things to consider there. Most notably, perhaps for most normal people in Britain, what the prices are going to do at the petrol pump in the near future.
Sadly.
But as an investor, how could one play this trend? The big oil companies have certainly surged back as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think a lot of investors just basically buy the likes of, you know, Royal Dutch Shell, BP, you know, ExxonMobil. And they're not bad ideas. They're pretty good ideas. Or a lot of more kind of stock picker orientated investors buy the mid-cap stuff, you know, the companies that are in the E&P space, as traditionally called. And so you've seen the share price of outfits like Premier Oil shoot up. I mean, I watch Premier Oil very carefully. It's one of the biggest producers in the North Sea. It has other outfits as well. EnQuest is a similar story, both listed on the London stock market. And their shares have really shot up because they're effectively leveraged plays. But the problem you've got with them is that they're taking idiosyncratic stock risk. Sounds a complicated term. But what you're basically betting on the company management to make the right decisions.
It's not just the price, of course.
Absolutely. Yeah. Whether or not they got the financial structure wrong. And that can go badly wrong in some cases. So even the really... You don't have to be reminded of what happened at BP. And even the really biggest companies can make bad strategic calls and they can invest too much money in the wrong thing at the wrong time. And it seems to me a pooled approach is a better idea. The other thing that's kicking around here is that a lot of people invest increasingly in sectors to get the dividend flow because Royal Dutch Shell and BP is probably going to restart its dividend. These are quite strong divvy payers. And it strikes me that going a more diversified approach, which is investing in a pool of energy companies, both mid and large cap, is a more sensible way of doing it, especially if you're after an income.
Thanks very much, David. And just to add, as I'm sure all listeners know, the podcast does discuss investment ideas, but it's absolutely not an endorsement of any of the securities discussed, nor does it constitute investment advice. If you need advice, go and find an independent advisor. Well, thanks for joining us. To read David's column, you can see the FT Money section inside Saturday's FT Weekend newspaper, or go online now to ft.com/money. That's all from the FT Money Show this week. If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us money@ft.com or tweet us a message @ftmoney. We will be back next week at the usual time. Goodbye.